No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you can join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to us at BBSRADIOPR. We have a special guest tonight, but first let me speak briefly about what's been going on in D.C. statehood. This week, we got our 204th co-sponsor, Bradley Schneider from Illinois' 10th District. Of course, he's a Democrat since we have no Republicans on the bill, but that's a new record for us. 204 co-sponsors on our bill to make D.C. the 51st state. So we're really happy about that. Thank you, Congressman Schneider. We so appreciate your support. And now, without further delay, let me introduce our guest. We have Ariel Moger from Friends of the Earth with us today to talk about the environment. Global climate change is, in my opinion, the thing that is most important, the issue that's most important facing all of us these days, especially young people, because they're going to have to deal with it. So Ariel has been kind enough to be on the show with us today so we can talk about some of the issues that surround this bigger issue of global warming the environment. Ariel, are you with us?
I am. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being on the show. And we meant to have you on last week, but there were some complications between our schedule, because last week was Earth Day, and so let's start there. I was involved, actually. I ran a PR firm and did a little work for Friends of the Earth, and I was involved in the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, and that was a long time ago. What are we up to now? We're up to 40-some years, right?
That Earth Day? Right.
Yeah, 1970. So that would be 49 years almost. Oh, my God, I'm getting so old. First of all, what do you think of Earth Day? What's the importance of this? Are we celebrating this all around the world these days?
Well, I definitely think that it's now a global holiday, which is really exciting. It is, well, personally, I always try and spend quality time in nature during Earth Day. So whether it's a hike or a picnic outside or volunteering to do a local cleanup, I like to celebrate by reconnecting with what I'm fighting for at Friends of the Earth. And as for what Friends of the Earth does, along with a lot of other environmental organizations, Earth Day is this great opportunity to remind our members just how important the environment is, and to urge them to take action, whether it be signing a petition on FOE.org or even calling their members of Congress to voice their opinions on environmental issues or specific votes that are coming up, or even taking it a step further and going in person to town halls or hearings. So, I think Earth Day, it's a great time to just remember to stand up for the environment in whatever capacity you can.
Well, a lot of people may not be aware of this, but Washington has some great outdoor spaces. You know, when I was in college, I lived on MacArthur Boulevard, right along the CNO Canal, and spent a lot of time along the Potomac River and Great Falls. And there's so much. We have such great green space in Washington, between all the monuments and the mall and other areas that I'm not sure everybody realizes that, but it's a great place to get out and be part of the environment. Unfortunately, on places like the mall and the Jefferson Memorial and all those areas, they're starting to dilapidate and the water's starting to rise. So let's start about talking about some of the bigger issues, and then maybe we can get a little more specific. The New Green Deal. What can you explain that to me? I'm not sure that I fully understand what the New Green Deal is. Do you?
Yes, so it is. Well, I guess a little bit of a background on it is that the Green New Deal is this concept that has been around for a while, but it really started getting traction thanks to Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And once she was elected to Congress, she and Senator Markey from Massachusetts introduced a resolution calling on Congress to implement this concept, the Green New Deal. And it's this really exciting opportunity to transform our society by addressing both climate change and economic inequality. So the basic idea is to create good-paying jobs in industries that don't harm our environment, like renewable energy or green infrastructure. And it's basically saying that we don't need fossil fuels or industrial agriculture to have a thriving economy and a healthy population. So yeah, it's this vehicle to hopefully move legislative policies forward that put people and the planet above corporations and dirty industries.
Well, you know, I first of all, let me say that my brother was president of, just retired as president of a community college in Ohio, where they put together the biggest solar field in America at the time, a couple of years ago. And it was a project that involved state and local and federal government, as well as his college. And it was a win-win. It was a great idea because he's in an area which was had a lot of job loss in Ohio. So they were training students how to install solar panels and making this large solar field, which now feeds the college with all the electricity, I believe, that it uses. So these are great projects and they're win-win. But let me ask you this. First of all, I'd like to point out that the Congresswoman and the Senator are both Democrats, and I understand that they brought this up before Congress, and the idea was endorsed, but only endorsed by Democrats, no Republicans. Is that true? Do you
Well,
know?
I've definitely been more discussion and solutions being posed by one party over another. The Democrats have definitely been talking more about climate change and the importance to act on it now. So, and not just at the, political top level, but, I think it was a recent CNN poll that said the top priority for Democratic voters right now is climate change. So, yes, there is definitely one party that seems to be taking it more seriously, and the Republicans have not really been putting forward any solutions or are, they're just continuing to drag their feet when we can't afford for us to drag our feet any longer. We need to act on climate now.
Let me ask you, are there still climate deniers in Congress? Are there still people that don't understand that there's global climate change and that we're the root of the problem? Are there, you know, I remember 20 years ago, certainly there were lots of, well, I wouldn't say lots, but there were several members of Congress who said, oh, you know, we're not at the root of this. This is exaggerated. Are there still people like that in Congress? Do we still have deniers?
There are definitely still deniers, but even so, there's kind of a spectrum, if not of outright denial, of, you know, just no desire to act on it, even if they do secretly believe it or not, they don't publicly, you know, voice that it's actually happening. And then there's other times where all of a sudden the same people who maybe 5 years ago were saying climate change isn't real are saying, well, we know climate change is real, but, you know, there's no reason to be doing et cetera, whatever is, you know, being proposed legislatively, and that's just not helpful. You know, we just need leaders, no matter what political party, we need leaders to be progressive and bold and moving forward, because scientists agree that we have a little over a decade to really change course and before we have to deal with even worse effects of climate change. So yeah, I just think that it's more important than ever to really pay attention to the way that your members talk about this issue, but also how they vote.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that I remember taking an environmental science course when I was in college a million years ago while the Earth was still forming, I think. But, you know, this was back in the 1970s, and everything that they said in that course, in my recollection, is coming true. You know, I remember them talking about extreme changes in the weather, about massive forest fires, about floods, about hurricanes that were, you know, kind of disproportionate to what we're used to, like we've seen in Louisiana and New Jersey and other places, more tornadoes and more extremes in weather. And I got to tell you, every time I turn on the news and I see one of these weather catastrophes, you know, I recollect from that course that that's exactly what they said was going to happen. And I don't fear so much for myself, but I do fear for my children and their children, because these are issues that people are going to really have to deal with. Now, let me tell you that I just came back from an international conference in Europe. There were people from 70 countries there, including three presidents. And global climate change was something that everybody wanted to talk about. So that's the good news, I guess. My question to you is, do you know how we're dealing internationally with issues, since global climate change is not something that any one country we can't resolve this problem by ourselves. We have to work together to do this. And I know that we pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. What else is going on internationally? Can you tell us? Are we doing any good things?
Well, I'm a little less familiar with the international landscape. As you mentioned, the Paris Agreement, the rest of the world, except for the United States, is a party to it, and they all have commitments that they are going to try and implement to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. As for the United States, you know, bringing it back to the Green New Deal, that's definitely something that could be implemented, if not only at the, you know, if there's resistance at the federal level, you know, there can be a Green New Deal at the state level, at the municipal level. There's already a number of legislative bodies throughout the United States that have been moving forward with Green New Deal legislation, and it's usually the same places that that are also still trying to implement the Paris Agreement. Excuse me. So it's one of these opportunities where we don't have to be stuck by the stalemate in Congress. We are still able to act and move forward and make a difference on this issue, but we also, obviously, for the scale that we need, we also need to make sure that in 2020 we are electing people that actually take this climate crisis as seriously as they need to.
Well, you know, we one thing I want to say about Washingtonians is that after our president pulled out of the climate accords, one of the first things that our mayor did was do exactly what you said. She restated our commitment in the District of Columbia to the objectives of the accords, and she signed environmental policy to do just that, to follow the accords. And people should, I'm glad to hear that other people are doing this locally, and we should do it locally if we can't do it nationally. But let me also ask you, does Friends of the Earth, do you rate candidates
environmental? We have endorsed in the past. We are not currently endorsing anyone at the moment. But yes, that's something that Friends of the Earth has done.
And do you rate them like, you know, like the National Rifle Association? God, I hate to use them as an example, but, you know, they rate candidates. They give them an A or a B or a C, you know, whatever, as far as gun policy. Do you do the same thing with candidates as far as their position on environmental legislation?
Well, we don't have a scorecard per se, but we definitely are very careful about who we endorse. We use criteria not only about their positions and history, if they have been in a legislative body, on environmentalism, but also how they are on other progressive issues. So we take multiple criteria into account, and that's usually the process that we use to determine who will endorse.
Great. And when do you do that? When do you'll do that next year, I assume?
Probably early next year, yes.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the bad news about recycling. All I hear lately is bad news about recycling. The Chinese won't take our trash anymore. The way that we're recycling, the way we're going about it is wrong. And, you know, we all think we're doing something great, right? I recycle everything we can, and, you know, and the way the DC plan is set up, and, you know, encourage my children to do it too when they're around. What's going wrong with recycling? What can we do? Do you know what we can do to change things to make it more effective?
Well, yeah, I think that this is a great question. So from what I remember reading, China is refusing mostly our plastic recycling, and obviously plastics has been a really important issue for a while, but it's been getting a lot more attention lately, which is great because it's definitely something that we need to be paying more attention to. And so I think you're right in pointing out how difficult it is for individuals who just want to do the right thing who want to be making a positive impact if they're unable to because of, you know, things that are out of their control. You know, what are the things that can be done in order to help remedy this situation? And I think that the solution that Friends of the Earth always advocates for is systemic change. So if the issue is that mostly that plastic is no longer being accepted by China for processing, or that when we're recycling, certain types of plastics are not recyclable, or, you know, it just gets very complicated and convoluted. And the burden shouldn't be on individuals to figure all this out. It should be on companies to, like, start transitioning away from non-recyclable materials and plastics And what we should be doing is demanding that our government supports and facilitates that kind of change. So even though, you know, for example, Friends of the Earth doesn't have a campaign specific to plastic reduction, about 99% of plastics are made from chemicals derived from fossil fuels. So you can argue that work to keep oil and gas in the ground addresses the supply side of the problem, while on the demand side of the issue, we just continue to advocate and demand that companies and our government, you know, start transitioning towards more sustainable materials and less single-use items in consumption in general.
Well, and can't we do stuff to make that, you know, improve the situation as well? I know my wife, who goes to the gym 4 days a week, carries a water bottle. She doesn't, you know, she refills it. She doesn't take those little bottles of water that you can buy at the store. She refills it and uses the same one over and over and over again. What do you think? Are we doing enough to educate people about this? Because, you know, shouldn't we be educating people and our children in schools how to be better environmentalists, since they're all going to have to deal with this someday? I mean, my kids have been out of high school for a while now, so I'm not sure what's being done. But it seems to me that everything we taught them, pretty much most of what we taught them about recycling and other things that they needed to be concerned about or could be involved in, we taught them at home. They weren't taught about it in school, and I think that's a shame. We really need to do more of that, don't you think?
I definitely agree. Yeah, I'm also not sure what schools are teaching, but I do think that that the conversations are happening in the public sphere more and more. So, for example, like the plastic issue was definitely something that was all over the place. You heard about it on the news. You know, there was plenty of actions on the internet, and so I think that general awareness is probably increasing, but we can always do more to continue increasing people's depth of knowledge on these issues. And it's crucial to be teaching children, and not just stop at children, but everyone of all ages, about all the ways that they can do more to make a positive impact, and not just at the individual level, where, for example, like you said, using reusable water bottles or using reusable bags, et cetera. You know, it's one of those things where, it's also getting people more civically engaged and participating in local politics and going out there and voting and having your representatives also have the same values as you.
Well, since we're on the subject, why don't you tell us what Friends of the Earth website is so that people can get involved?
So Friends of the Earth is FOE.org. I often refer to it as FOE. And there are plenty of campaigns that are ranging from food and protecting our oceans, as well as opposing nuclear projects and protecting our public lands from fossil fuel extraction. So you can go on the website, foe.org, and sign petitions and find other ways to get involved in one of those or many of those campaigns.
Well, let me say, just since you brought up plastics, our great research team here at Shadow Politics has put together some statistics for me. And in case you don't understand, if you're out there listening, I've got one here that really strikes me, that 8 million tons of plastic end up in the ocean each year. That's just amazing to me. And, you know, a little bit of education goes a long way. My wife and I, many years ago, almost 30 years ago, went and had an encounter with dolphins in Hawaii. And I remember that they told us that one of the things that was a hazard to bottlenose dolphins was plastic rings, the kind you get with a six-pack of Coke or beer. And my wife, since that day, I can tell you, we've never gotten anything that comes like that. My wife hasn't cut the rings apart because she remembers that it's a problem for dolphins. But so very little education sometimes goes a very long way. Once people know what they can do to help, they do. Talk a little bit about what's going on with the oceans, because I know that you were at one time, again, my crackerjack staff here Shadow Politics tells me that you were involved in a sea level rise adaptation project. What is a sea level rise adaptation project?
Right. So before I moved to Washington, D.C., I lived in Florida. I'm originally from there. So after college, I returned and worked for the city of Miami Beach. And oftentimes, whenever people are talking about climate change, they love to point out how in X amount of years, Miami Beach will be underwater. And so working for the government when all of this is happening, when people keep using it as an example of a place that's going to be negatively impacted by sea level rise, it was definitely one of the priorities of the city to not only work on adaptation, which is the, you know, it's a mixture of changing stormwater infrastructure from gravity, they used to be gravity-based, to actually have pumps that would pump out water, because as the tides would get higher, salt water would push its way up through the stormwater infrastructure and make its way onto the streets, and which is obviously not good for the bottom of cars or for plants that are usually used to fresh water. So, you know, making those kinds of transitions, those hard infrastructural changes, as well as green infrastructural changes, so restoring natural habitats such as mangroves and wetlands, because they act as natural buffers and natural solutions to many of the problems that arise from climate change impacts on a barrier island, which is what it is. So it was a really interesting time to be working there. It felt very much like we were on the front lines and we were trying out new things adaptation-wise, but also making sure that we were thinking about the mitigation side and seeing how we could make Miami Beach, emit less greenhouse gases, and how we could improve our urban canopy and add more green spaces. So, and making places more bicycle friendly and things like that, so people could walk more and use cars less. So there were all these really cool opportunities that presented itself, because we were already feeling the impacts. We were already seeing the challenges of sea level rise when on a, you know, beautiful sunny day, we were getting salt water flooding our streets. So, yeah, I learned a lot from that experience, and it's definitely been helpful in my work with Friends of the Earth.
Well, you know, we have a caller on line two, Lynn, who has a question. So let's get her on and see what Lynn has to say. Lynn, are you there?
Yes, hello. Actually, it's not really a question. I've worked with Friends of the Earth. I love you guys. I just wanted to give some more information out. There is a new, it's called New renewable bank. It's a new resource bank. You might want to check it out. They're working with new recycling projects that they're funding. And Recycle Sweden, they're doing an amazing thing. They're way ahead of us in Europe, Recycle Sweden. And I just wanted to say about the hemp farms to help replace, you know, the fossil fuel type of plastics. And also, too, there's desalinization plants. You might want to get involved with looking at those. The youth, I'm so glad you're here. And then the Sunrise Movement, I wanted to make sure you were affiliated with them. So thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for calling in, Lynn, and that's important information. And, you know, I worry so much about what we just talked about, Ariel, because one of the things that I love most about this area is the Chesapeake Bay. And first, let me just say that when you talk about salt water coming onto to land, I'm not sure that everybody realizes what a devastating effect this will have on agriculture. You know, I remember from my history lessons that when Julius Caesar invaded Carthage, he flooded the land with salt water, and that 1,000 years later, they still couldn't grow crops on that land. So this is really, having salt water on dry land is a big problem, especially to agriculture. But I worry about the rising tide because there are so many lovely places in the Chesapeake. I don't know how much you know about the Chesapeake Bay, but there are a lot of barrier islands and small little places out in the bay that will probably be drastically affected by rising tides. And also, I think it's a great political example because the Bay, we've had really hard policy choices to make with the Chesapeake Bay because it involves Pennsylvania, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. And to get these people to cooperate with each other is a challenge. Do you find that in your work? I know that I'm a big lover of hard-shell crabs, and I know that was always a problem, was that they could never get D.C., Maryland, and Virginia to agree on policies that were good for the crab population. Do you find that in working in this region that it's really tough because of all the having the three separate governments with three or four separate governments with all with different priorities?
Well, I'm not sure how much Friends of the Earth work specifically on like Chesapeake Bay specific, but I do know that we work in a coalition, for example, on a number of these issues with other environmental groups, with local community leaders, and with grassroots efforts, volunteers. And with the good thing that this provides to us is it's many people that are participating and getting involved in the process. But obviously people have different points of view, different perspectives. And so it is a challenge, but I think Friends of the Earth is very adamant about making sure that all stakeholders are included in the decision-making processes, whatever they may be, and that usually the voices that tend to be ignored, so whether it's indigenous voices or lower income or people of color, usually the communities that are most impacted negatively by our environmental policies, if they're, you know, that they're brought to the table and that they're not just listened to, but their advice is actually, you know, implemented into these decisions. So it's more challenging, it's harder, but I think it's worth it in the end because it can't always just be a top-down approach to environmentalism.
Well, you know, and I visited the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, and I could tell you, very often low-income people suffer the brunt of this stuff. And after Katrina, I went to New Orleans, I think it was 3 years later, and somebody took me on a tour, and I couldn't believe the devastation, even 3 years later. nothing had been rebuilt. It was just incredible to me. I'd never seen a natural disaster like that, that kind of devastation. And I once drove into a town in Oklahoma 10 minutes after a tornado had swept through the town. So I've seen some bad weather in my time, but I've never seen anything like that. It's just amazing. But so tell me, what is your major political obstacle? Because I got to tell you, things like drilling for oil in the national parks, when I was 18, I went around the country and I went to many national parks. And drilling for oil in a national park, to me, just seems crazy. It just seems like a crazy idea. So what is your political... I don't understand why people come up with ideas like this. What's your biggest political obstacle, you think, in getting reasonable environmental legislation through Congress?
Good question. Well, it's probably related to the amount of influence that these polluting industries have on our politicians. So they have, you know, an unfair amount of access. In this administration in particular, many of the people that are at the top in Trump's cabinet, they are former fossil fuel lobbyists, coal lobbyists, and so they're coming from that world, and now they're supposed to be regulating their former clients, or they're supposed to be, you know, all of a sudden protecting the environment when they've had an entire career before them, you know, decades of fighting against most of the comprehensive policies that environmentalists have valued over the years. So I think that we're living in this strange time where there's, like I said, unprecedented access of the fossil fuel industry, you know, in politics. And so Friends of the Earth has multiple campaigns that are dedicated to fighting fossil fuel extraction on, like you said, public lands, but also in our oceans. And so in addition to elevating the scientific and social reasons for not drilling or mining in specific areas, we've also been working to expose the corruption and abuse of power that's been so rampant in this administration. So I'm sure you've probably read some of the headlines about former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and former Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke.
EPA guy, isn't he a climate denier?
Well, they're very vague about it, but in addition to their bad environmental policies, they also were just doing really strange, ridiculous things that ended up being scandals. And the level of corruption eventually led to their forced resignations. And now their replacements, which are Andrew Wheeler and David Bernhardt, they're just as corrupt and they're just as anti-environment. So we just need to continue doing our work to remove these unethical anti-environmentalists from the federal agencies that are supposed to be protecting us and the environment. So, yeah, it's a challenge, but it's definitely something that, as we saw with the recent victories of Pruitt and Zinke being kicked out of office, I think that there is still work that can be done to still present a challenge and just not make it so easy for them to get by with their pro-pollution agenda.
Well, you know, and I don't know that people out there listening realize how important some of the stuff that you just said it is, really. I covered the Farm Bill in 1PL480 when it was first introduced, and the Sierra Club pulls in half a dozen experts, but then the grain manufacturers and the other people that have big bucks, they pull in people that know everybody that's on the dais. They're friendly with every member of Congress to which they speak, and that's a powerful thing for them. And I'm sure that's true of the oil lobby and also you know, chemical manufacturers and people like that. And they produce experts. Let me tell you, they're very impressive sometimes. I remember in covering the legislation one time where AT&T had to testify, and they brought out four Nobel Prize winning scientists that worked for them. So, they're not only cozy with these people, but they really understand how to affect them. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, I don't know that they realize that you can have a member of Congress that before they were elected was a lawyer or a you know, could have owned a business or could have been a farmer, could have done anything, and may not and has to rely on the expertise of people that come before them in order to craft legislation. And when you control the information, you control the legislation. So that's very important. And I think you're right. I think that citizens are starting to stand up. And that politicians, it's the only way to reach politicians is to stand up to them and let them know that you're only going to vote for people that support your best interests. So let's make sure everybody's out there doing that. Let me ask you about deforestation, because I know that when I was a student in college, that was a big issue. Deforestation, it says our research says that it contributes to 15% of all greenhouse emissions. Is that still true? I know that the advent of the internet has reduced the need for paper dramatically. And so are things getting better when deforestation?
Well, the number sounds correct. I'm not sure if I can properly assess whether it's getting better or worse. I just know that we have a number of campaigns at Friends of the Earth that works to defund or to how do I say this? They try and advocate so that financial institutions stop funding companies and projects that result in the deforestation of areas internationally. So I know that one issue that we've been involved in is palm oil, for example, which is it's something that is just used in so many beauty products and is something that rarely, you know, people don't usually hear about. But unless it is done sustainably, it tends to be a really destructive practice where these companies go into developing countries and clear-cut their forests, ignoring indigenous rights and ignoring the demands or will of the local communities. And they plant, you know, these palms that are, you know, in order to harvest them and feed the demand that the Western world has for its, you know, beauty products and some of its food. So on the one hand, even if we're trying to decrease, if we're focusing on one thing like paper, you know, you never know if there's something else that is still causing, especially in places outside of the United States, to try and fill a demand, and they do so in an unsustainable way.
And I assume they can do that there are methods that they could harvest the palm oil and do it sustainably. It's just probably more complicated and more expensive. Is that right?
It can be done, and I think that there is a certification, so you can actually see in a label when something is produced with sustainably harvested palm oil. But other than that, there's definitely different agricultural practices that still lead to deforestation. And so Friends of the Earth works on the one hand, the financial institutions to cease funding for those types of projects, but also, you know, working with community leaders to help them defend their own area from these, you know, corporations coming in and taking their land.
Are we doing enough to support, I think I know the answer to this question, are we doing enough to support the growth of sustainable energy businesses like people that like the development of solar power and distribution of clean clean fuels and other things like that? Are we doing enough as a government? Are we putting enough money into this technology?
No. No, yeah. We are not. Despite the lack of support, though, from the federal level, the solar industry and wind industry just continue to grow steadily, and prices continue to drop for materials and technologies, and it's kind of thriving despite the obstacles, or at least lack of support that it should be receiving from the federal level. So if it were any other time in history, perhaps we would be doing what we should be doing, which is doubling down on renewable and then doing a massive scale expansion of, you know, these projects. But instead, it's very much being driven, from the bottom up, and it's being relatively successful despite the lack of support from the top.
Well, I know that politically, you know, this is important. I run for re-election. I've been re-elected 3 times, and every piece of literature that I produce is on recycled paper, printed with soy ink and wind power. And we make a big deal about it. We make sure that we put in big letters at the bottom of our literature that it's recycled paper. We use soy ink, which is biodegradable. We use wind power. We only use vendors that use wind power. You have to insist upon these things, I believe, to make sure that your politicians fall in line and do the right thing. But I can't understand why, given the economic benefit, for example, to solar power, why we're not putting more into it. You know, we could be training thousands of people like they did at my brother's college. We could be training people to work in the solar power industry. It's growing, or wind power. I know that I go through I go to Chicago sometimes to visit my daughter, and my wife and I drive through Indiana, and there's these gigantic wind farms in Indiana all over the place. I don't know why we don't have them in other places, though. It seems to me that, economically as well as environmentally, these policies make sense. But let me ask you, we're running out of time here. What do you want to say, Ariel, that we haven't talked about? Is there something that you think is important to this discussion that we haven't touched on?
One subject. Let's see. Well, growing up in Florida, I could talk about oceans all day long, so I don't know if you have interest in that.
Of course. Of course we have interest in the oceans, yes.
What's been happening lately? The Trump administration has been really trying its hardest to sell off our oceans to big oil, big surprise. And thankfully, though, there have been some recent court decisions about the protections that President Obama had put in place before he left. And because of that, it has been delaying the administration's attempts to get out a new what's called 5-year plan, which is a big lease sale that would sell off portions of our oceans to oil and gas companies so that they can drill. And so even though that's a positive, we have a win thanks to that the recent decisions having to do with the five-year plan, there are other ways that the Trump administration continues to try and do big oil's bidding. And these are things that a lot of people aren't aware of. And so that's why I wanted to bring it up to discuss, because there should be some outrage over these things that I'm about to talk about. Like, first of all, is the administration has recently been rolling back safeguards that were put in place after the Deepwater Horizon disaster.
Yeah, quickly we forget, huh?
Right, okay, exactly. And so they think that because it's not in the news or whatever, that they can get away with it. But these were safeguards that were put in place to protect not only, you know, the Gulf environment, but people's lives and people's livelihoods. So I personally find that very it's outrageous to me. So that's why I could talk about it all day long. But on top of that, they are also proceeding with approving permits that would allow companies to use extremely loud and disruptive seismic cannons, basically, to blast the Atlantic Ocean to search for oil and gas deposits deep under the ocean floor. And so that's another issue where they try and dress it up as it's not that big of an issue because we're just looking for oil and gas, but it's often the first step before they start actually drilling. And when you drill, you spill. That's the saying. So, it's Friends of the Earth and our coalition partners have just been working extremely hard to fight the administration on all these terrible policies because our oceans are one of our most valuable resources. And I'm Absolutely. Obviously biased coming from Miami because I grew up on the water and I love the ocean. But I always like to quote Dr. Sylvia Earle. She always says, "No water, no life, no blue, no green." And I think it's obviously those words are extremely true. So anytime I can talk about standing up for our oceans against big oil, I'll take the opportunity. So thank you.
Well, good. And I think that, you know, you now have to come back at some point, because I think that's a discussion for a whole show. I mean, what we're doing to the world's oceans. But do we have a caller, Doug? I think
last
I saw
minute
we had
caller here. Sorry to come in so late.
No, please.
And switching gears just a little bit, wanted to talk real quickly about the recycling symbols, the resin identification codes on bottles, and why, with all of the concerns about plastics and plastic in the oceans, and the fact that we recycle so few of the water bottles, it goes on, how come there are so many pieces of plastic, bottle caps and that's just one thing that comes to mind, but so many things where the codes are either, the resin identification codes are either not on the item at all, or they're printed on the bottom and are barely visible. So your average consumer, you know, is not going to take out a magnifying glass and try to figure out whether something is recyclable where they live. And I'm just wondering why we aren't all over this, especially with the concerns about single-use plastics.
Well, you know, that's
a recycling symbol on everything.
That's a great comment, because I can't tell you how many times I have to look at the bottom of the bottle and say to my wife, is this recyclable? Do we recycle fives or fours or threes? I think there should be a simpler system, too, that says, yes, recycle, no, but, you know. I think that's a very, very good point that you bring up, and thank you. Thanks for calling in. Unfortunately, we're going to have to ask Ariel to come back to answer that question because we're out of time. But thank you so much for calling in. Thanks, Ariel, for being on the show. Let's give the Friends of the Earth website one more time before we leave.
Sure. It's foe.org, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for and let me wish everybody out there a great Cinco de Mayo. Please go out and have a margarita today. Remember that next week is Mother's Day, and the ultimate mother is Mother Earth. So try to do something nice for Mother Earth. And we're going to leave you with a song from one of our favorite sons, Marvin Gaye. And this goes out to Ariel from Friends of the Earth. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you again.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go?
Representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.